Jenkins for the appellant, Ms. Martin for the Commonwealth. Mr. Jenkins, sir, would you like to reserve time for the rebuttal?
Yes, please, 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
Speedy trial day of the court.
I was about to say, I didn't know I was here on speedy trial day. Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, my name is Bill Dinkin, and I represent the appellant, Bradford Gaskins, and I'm doing this in conjunction with the University of Richmond pro bono appellate committee. Unfortunately, the student that I was working with is studying at the bar, so this is going to be my argument today, rather than his.
I guess they have the priorities right, so.
Yeah.
Mr. Dinkin, let me interrupt you if I can, because I'm looking at, this is an interesting issue that has come up in this case that, frankly, would be one of first impression for us. I'm looking at Code Section 19.2-270.5, which is specific to DNA evidence.
Yes, sir.
And as I read that statute, it says it requires that the Commonwealth give notice to defense counsel if they intend to rely on DNA evidence, and then if they fail to give notice, certain things can happen, and that was the case here. But the statute, I'm not sure the General Assembly actually thought this through very carefully, but it's not up to me to second-guess them. It says what it says. It says, in the event such notice is not given, which, of course, is the case here, and the person proffers such evidence, the person here being the Commonwealth attorney at trial, and they did so, then the court may, in its discretion, either allow the opposing party a continuance or under appropriate circumstances, bar the person from presenting such evidence. Then the sentence goes on, or the next sentence says, the period of any such continuance shall not be counted for speedy trial purposes. Now, obviously, one way to read that, assuming you read it literally, is that despite the fact that the Commonwealth was the one requesting, despite the fact that they failed to give notice, the court granted allowed them to do so, granted a continuance. And it seems to me that sentence arguably suggests that that continuance, even though it was initiated by the failure of the Commonwealth to do something it was statutorily required to do, would nevertheless not be counted for speedy trial purposes. And if that's the case, we've got nothing else to talk about here, do we?
Well, I think it, again, the question is arguably, how do you interpret this? And
Don't apply the plan. I mean, the plan right. Says what it says. How do we get around it, I guess, is the question.
Well, what my interpretation of the statute and what I would urge this court to adopt is that the tolling language in 19.2-270.5 applies when the party opposing the request for the continuance, when it's granted over that opposition. So in this case, the way it's set up is that the Commonwealth came in. They needed the extra time to satisfy the 21 days. The court heard we'll call it a good cause argument for that continuance. Appellant opposed the request for the continuance. And at that point, the statute uses the term that the speedy trial will be told for any such continuance granted. And that's the key language. Any such continuance has to be referring to the request. And so the only way to read this statute is that it only tolls in a situation, it would only toll against a defendant, for example, if they were the one asking for the continuance. Here, the Commonwealth asked for it. The statute's pretty clear that it only tolls in the other direction.
Well, I understand that argument, but we have, I guess it's an exercise in statutory construction,
right?
Because we have the general speedy trial statute, which of course provides for certain things. We may or may not ever get to this, but it just seems to me we need to address this out
sure.
of the box.
I hope we get to it.
This is a specific statute that deals with, and of course, as you're well aware, one of the canons of statutory construction is that a specific statute will trump a general statute if they cannot be harmonized.
Right.
Now, I gather you're suggesting they can somehow be harmonized here. So,
well, I think this is specific, and I think that this is specific that the period of any such continuance is not counted for speedy trial. And the only way to read that is that any such continuance would be the one whoever's asking for it. And so, in this case, it can't.
In this case, the Commonwealth asked, or the defendant asked for it.
No, the Commonwealth asked for the continuance.
Well, then any such continuance shall not be. So if the Commonwealth requested the continuance and got it, such continuance shall not be counted for speedy trial purposes. That's what the statute says.
Well, so it says if such notice is not given, then the court may, in its discretion, either allow the opposing party. So we've got to go back. It's a three-step process. May, in its discretion, either allow the opposing party a continuance. And so what we're talking about here is the appellant is opposing the introduction of the DNA evidence because it doesn't meet the 21 days. So that's step one. And then the court can decide whether, for good cause, the DNA evidence, there will be a continuance in order to allow the 21-day notice. So that would be step two, and the court reached that. And then allow the opposing party a continuance. So in this case, the appellant never asked for a continuance. The appellant's the opposing party. And then the third step is the period of any such continuance. So now we're talking about if the opposing party asks for a continuance, right? That links it back to the last sentence. And so once we're there, because the opposing party, again, the party opposing the introduction of the DNA evidence, did not ask for the continuance, then there's no tolling. Under the plain language, it says any such continuance is not counted for speedy trial purposes. And so that I think that, you know, we don't want to rewrite the General Assembly statute. They may have thought they had it covered. I don't think they anticipated a situation like this. It's not our job, certainly.
Well, I don't want to belabor that point. Can I ask you, assuming we get past all that and,
right.
and start doing the math on the rest of it. Would you agree that, assuming there had been no delays whatsoever, given that the clock started running on your client's arrest on the indictment,
right.
that the trial date should have been honored before June 23rd, 2014?
That's correct, and I think that the Commonwealth agrees to that.
All right, and then the next continuance was from that date to May 19th, 2014, and all of that time counts towards the speedy trial. In other words, none of those days would have the effect of tolling.
My argument is that it never tolled, that the 152
I'm trying to do a piece by piece.
Right.
Sort of way I can work through.
And these are difficult. We need timelines.
Sometimes I have to take off my shoes and socks.
I spent hours trying to figure out the times.
All right. And then from May 20th through 2014 through June 23rd, that's 35 days. And the reason for that, didn't your client acquiesce in that continuum?
So now we've reached the nub of that other. This is fascinating. only academically, I'm sure. But
I went to law school so I could avoid math.
This is so interesting and so different. And you all have experience as trial lawyers, and we know that.
What was the reason for that continuum?
So what happened? And this is odd, and I don't see this happen very often, but. When the case was initially set, and of course the initial trial date, that's a key phrase, when the initial trial date is set, because then if that initial trial date is changed, then we do have a tolling. And this is what happens. The public defender came in and said, "Judge, my client's not ready to acquiesce or waive his jury trial rights." And the court says, we'll set an election day. I think that was April 28th.
A tentative trial date.
Well, so there were two dates that were set. They set what they call an election day, and that was on the 28th of April. And that's where counsel and appellant are to come in and indicate, do they want a jury trial or do they want a bench trial? And they also set...
There was no objection to that.
No, and there was nothing about that would toll the statute of limitations. Going from that falls within, it doesn't change the initial trial date. And my contention is there was no initial trial date. They set a May 19th, and I call it a tentative bench trial date. And I think that, what the court wanted to do is reserve some a date if he was going to take a bench trial, because we know it's tough to get trial dates. But the appellant hadn't acquiesced to that. He hadn't indicated he wanted a bench trial. He hadn't made any decision about what kind of trial he wanted. And so what we see, the new counsel comes in. That doesn't change any, it doesn't change the election day. He's available. They come in on that election day. And he's unfortunately not available in case there's a bench trial on the 19th that's selected. But that, again, we don't know if that's going to be the trial date or not, because the appellant hasn't made that decision yet. That's got to be made on the election day.
Counsel, I've got a question.
Sure. And I know I'm at my...
Your revised knowledge answer to Donald's question.
Great. Well, thank you, Judge.
Sure. Mine is a little bit more of a procedural question.
Okay.
And the question is, there are two different tasks in speedy trial that are being taken, one of which is the Sixth Amendment violation, the other one which is the statutory
right.
violation. The question I have is, the hearing heard in October, the motion that's filed by trial counsel is styled as a Sixth Amendment.
Right.
But the body of it contains language that tracks the statutory speedy trial. And I assume that you would concede that we don't have a copy of that transcript where the court made that determination.
No, I wish we did. When the case came to me on appeal, the transcript had already been ordered. And I didn't even know there was a hearing that day. But that's an aside. The real answer, that's defensive of me.
Let me stop you in terms of making it an aside. The court rules of 5A8 indicate that we can't decide a case if there's some indispensable transcript.
Right.
We did not know what the trial court decided regarding the speedy trial, whether it was decided on Sixth Amendment grounds, statutory grounds, or a mixture. So my question for you is, what are we supposed to do not having had that record or that court's decision?
Well, I said it's kind of a two-part question. Maybe even three parts, see if I can address this. Counsel for the appellant objects in writing. Well, first he objects at the DNA continuance date back. Go ahead.
Let me just ask you a question.
Sure.
About that, because what he sort of says is, I haven't done the calculation
right.
about this speedy trial. I has to qualify it as sort of a squishy objection, because it's nothing specific. There's nothing in terms of the exact time frame. In fact, when he gets further into the objection as to the continuance for the DNA notice, what he actually says is, well, I don't think the cause has been shown. So where exactly would be the objection to the speedy trial?
He makes two objections, and one is on the good cause. That he also objects. He says, my client has been incarcerated for 5 months and X days, and I can't remember the exact date. We object to the continuance. We are ready to go to trial. And then we know that the speedy trial issue was pointedly put to the court because the prosecutor then went through, you'll recall from the transcript, goes through the process of this is told and this tolls and this is... And so pretty very clearly it was treated by the prosecutor and the trial judge as having a speedy trial, statutory speedy trial component. Otherwise, why in the world would the prosecutor have detailed the various tolling events? And then Mr. Lassiter goes on and argues his good cause. So there are two parts to it, without, I think, any question in the transcript. Was it squishy? It wasn't as specific as it could be. But clearly, for 5A 18, I'm sorry, that's not your role. it's been identified, preserved, put to the trial court, in fact, to this extent that the prosecutor even responds by providing tolling. So it's clearly right in front of the court. And he's opposing it. He's objecting to the continuance, saying that his client has been incarcerated for 5 months and X number of days, and he's opposing it on speedy trial grounds. He filed a written motion to the other question that you asked on constitutional speedy trial only. That's the only thing that was in his written motion, was that he objected on constitutional speedy trial. The Commonwealth responded with a lot of detail primarily on statutory grounds. I'm sorry I don't have the transcript for that. It certainly went against the appellant.
Well, at this point, we're not worried about a constitutional speech.
No, I'm not. That wasn't even a good argument. I wasn't going to raise that. With all due respect to trial counsel, it wasn't going to fly.
We're going to save the question answered then.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll put the extra time on for your rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Dinkins. Martin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth asks that these convictions be affirmed because there was no speedy trial violation in this case.
Do we even need to get to the statute I alluded to earlier, 19.2270.5, to resolve this? Is that something we need to deal with, statutory construction between the two statutes?
No, you don't have to get there, Your Honor. It's an interesting argument. With respect to that, I think I could read the statute a little differently than the court did, but we don't have to get to that because we've got several other arguments that will support the convictions as far as the speedy trial issue goes. First of all, with regard to the fact that there was the defendant's motion for speedy trial and the hearing that was held in October, the defendant's motion was a Sixth Amendment motion. The prosecutor's response was pretty much a statutory kind of response. The court's order on page 130 of the appendix simply says the defendant's motion, speedy trial motion, is denied. And so without having a transcript of that hearing, and that appears to be the only transcript that's missing from this case. There are lots of transcripts, but that one is not here. We don't really know what arguments were made to the trial court or what the trial court's actual ruling was. All we know is that the motion was denied. And at the June 18th hearing, which was where the Commonwealth asked for the continuance because of the new DNA evidence.
Let me stop you. You haven't said it, but I guess the implication of your argument would be, since we don't know what specific arguments were made, and we only know that the grounds for the motion alleged in the written motion were constitutional, irrespective of what the Commonwealth's response was, we don't know the basis for the court's denial. It could have been denied on constitutional grounds. Is that your argument?
Right. We don't know the basis for the court's denial. We don't know that the defendant ever made the arguments to the trial court that he has made on appeal. Because at the June 18th hearing, he objected to the continuance, and he said, well, there's not really good cause. They've had this DNA for a long time, and now they're just coming up with the new testing. And on page 48, when the Commonwealth, defense attorney says, well, my client has been in jail for 5 months, but he doesn't contest the Commonwealth statements that the Commonwealth had said, you know, we're within the speedy trial grounds when we set this new case, when we set the new trial date on July 14th. And the defendant did not contest that. The defendant didn't object when the Commonwealth talked about the tolling that would have occurred from the dates in April when there was a new attorney appointed and when the original bench trial date had to be changed.
Counsel, doesn't he mention that there might be the potential for a speedy trial issue, but he's just not done a specific calculation as to the time frame? So he does alert the trial court that there is a statutory issue with the speedy trial.
I think, Your Honor, he had to be much more specific in that in regard to responding to specifically what the Commonwealth had said. You know, if the Commonwealth hadn't said anything about, well, this speedy trial hasn't run yet and so forth and so on, and the defendant had just said, I want to point out my client's been in jail for 5 months, I think he'd be in a much stronger position. But he had some responsibility to contest what the Commonwealth was saying, to put the trial court on notice that I don't agree with the fact that these time periods have been told. Simply saying, you know, he's been in jail for 5 months, I haven't personally calculated this, and he kind of implies, well, I'm not disagreeing with what they said, I'm not taking issue with that, I'm just pointing this out that he's been here. And so he maybe is saying to the trial judge, well, there could be a problem, but then the Commonwealth comes back and talks about these tolling periods on page 53 of the appendix, and the defendant doesn't say anything. He doesn't say, oh, that's not right, or no, that's not the law. So it's like he's agreeing with what the Commonwealth has said. And so
well,
that
sounds to me like it would be logical to infer that if you're filing a motion and only alleging constitutional grounds, and then in the course of your argument indicate that you haven't done the calculations on the statutory grounds, that the constitutional grounds is the only grounds you're relying on.
Right. I mean, there's just really nothing. When you really look at this record closely, there's really nothing where the defendant has made the particular statutory arguments that he later then made on appeal. And he does disagree with the fact that that 19.2 to 70.5, the tolling aspect. He does argue that point to the trial court at June 18th. But that's really the only thing that he has talked about in terms of the speedy trial, and that was in connection with saying that there's no good cause to grant a continuance based on this new DNA evidence. So certainly... And then the other thing is that his motion on Sixth Amendment grounds came after he had said in July that he was waiving his speedy trial concerns, that he was waiving his speedy trial rights. He said that in two different points in July at hearings there, and then he comes back later in September with the Sixth Amendment speedy trial motion. So clearly the arguments have not been properly preserved and they're not before the court. But assuming that they are, for the sake of argument, we have the various time periods here that are told or counted against the defendant. Certainly there was a 5-month limit, and so if none of the April dates, if none of that changed, we would have a speedy trial deadline of June 23rd. But on April 4th, there was a hearing where the defendant had to get a new attorney because his existing attorney had some sort of conflict with one of the Commonwealth's witnesses. And the new attorney said, well, I'm not available on May 19th. Now, I would also like to direct the court's attention to the hearing in February where the trial dates were set. And the defense attorney was the one who asked for two dates. That's on page 22 and 23 of the appendix. He wanted a motions hearing date and maybe at that point a status to elect a jury or a bench trial, and that was set for April 28th. And then he also said, I want to set a bench trial just in case that's what we have on May 19th. And so that was put on the court's calendar as a scheduled bench trial, and that was done at the request of the defense attorney. Then we had a new attorney on April 4th, and he said, I'm not available on 5/19. So that date was taken off the court's calendar, and the court said, well, you all get together and pick a new date, which they did. Then on April 28th is when the defendant elected the jury trial, and it was set for June 23rd. So certainly the case law, Stinney, Balance, Howard, all of those cases talk about where the initial trial date is set, and then there is a continuance. The continuance tolls the time under these circumstances because it was for the benefit of the defendant to get an attorney who would be prepared for trial. And as in the Heath case where the defendant made his motion for psychiatric examination, and the court said, well, that's an implicit request to continue because he was not ready for trial until he had his... psychiatric examination, and here the defendant didn't waive counsel. He didn't say, I want to represent myself. So he was not ready for trial until he had an attorney who was prepared. And so for those reasons, the time after April 4th, and certainly after between April 28th and June 23rd, is time that is counted against the defendant and not the Commonwealth. Furthermore, as discussed in the earlier case this morning, the defendant did not object to the continuances in April. And that's pages 37 and 43 of the appendix. And if he just simply did not object to the trial court's setting those dates. He didn't say, wait, that's not going to be counted against me. He did nothing like that. And so certainly... because the statute in 1995 was amended to show that the defendant must affirmatively object to the continuances, and he did not do that. So certainly that's another reason why there's no speedy trial violation in this instance. And then later he asked for his own DNA expert. That's another thing that was for his benefit that also would have told the time. If the court would like me to address the 19.2 to 75 thing, I will be happy to do so. Otherwise, I will just rely on my brief, and we ask that the convictions be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Martin.
The Virginia Supreme Court states in Howard versus Commonwealth, which is 281 Virginia 455, that once the initial trial date is set, every continuance postpones the trial date. And so it seems to me that this case comes down to whether the May 19th tentative bench trial was the initial trial date. And that's at least the threshold, so I can get to my 270.5 argument. So we need to get through there.
How do you read it on any other way than it is an actual trial date when the attorney who's first representing the appellant says, I'd like to set it for a trial date, and it's actually, I believe it's the judge who suggests setting another status date just in case there's a request for a jury?
Actually, the attorney asks for both. He comes in and he says, I'd like to ask the court for two dates. The only way I think that we can read that is that it's a tentative trial date. And this is a really unique, you don't get this every day, where someone says, well, let's reserve this day, but I don't know if my client hasn't decided whether he wants a jury trial or a bench trial.
So I guess it's a rose by any other name kind of situation, because I think we can all agree that if you set it, if you file a bunch of motions and you set it down for a hearing on motions, that's not a trial date.
Correct.
But when you pick a date and the understanding is that it could be a trial date, even if there's a possibility it'll be further continued because of logistical issues of getting a jury or whatever, I mean, a trial date, if you use the term of art trial date, then I guess there's a suggestion that there's at least a, if not a probability, at least a strong possibility that an actual trial will be held on that date unless something else intervenes.
Without quantifying the probability that there's going to be a trial on the 19th. The real question is, what were these parties, what did the defense attorney, what did the court, what were they thinking when they had reserved this day? And, of course, we can only know for sure by looking at the transcript and trying to divine.
So, assuming, would you respond to Ms. Martin's argument that the date involving the missing transcript, we have the assertion by the Commonwealth that the only grounds advanced for the motion to continue were constitutional, and an order from the court continuing it, then where does that leave us, assuming we determine that we would need a transcript to evaluate whether or not the request was made pursuant to the statute?
Right. So I'm looking at two separate instances where defense counsel opposes. First, on June 18th, when the Commonwealth asked for their DNA. And at that point, my argument, what I asked this court to accept, is that the objection to the continuance was statutory, on statutory grounds. And it wasn't perfect, I'll concede that, but it alerted the court that the appellant was objecting on statutory grounds, and I think that's why they went through this calculation process and why he was saying how long his client had been incarcerated. Then, sometime later, after the court had granted that continuance for the purpose of the DNA, defense counsel files a written motion on constitutional grounds alone. I don't know if that really matters in this, because that's what was presented to the court. This is an objection to the continuance on constitutional grounds. Perhaps he was advancing that because he hadn't raised it the first time and thought that he could preserve it. But really, the operative question is whether at the June 18th hearing, when the Commonwealth asked for their continuance for the purpose of getting in the DNA evidence, was the issue identified by defense counsel? Was the court alerted to what the issue was, statutory speedy trial, and was the court in a position to address it?
Do we also know what the basis for the court's decision. In other words, okay. Alternate bases for a decision can be made, and we, because of a lack of a transcript or record, right. We don't know what the actual basis for the decision was. All we have is, here are alternate reasons for asking for something. Here's an order granting something. How are we going to pick and choose as to what the rationale was?
Well, we do have a transcript of June 18th. Right. We know what was presented to the court, and the court chose not to elaborate on its ruling, ruled against the appellant and granted the continuance. But we know that those issues were presented. Then defense counsel raises constitutional speedy trial, and I don't think that really is relevant to consideration of this appeal because I'm not raising it on appeal. So it really, I don't see where that really matters. The issue certainly was raised, identified, and ruled on by the court. And so I think everything that you need in order to make that decision is before you.
Thank you, sir. You are out of time, okay. So we will come down and brief counsel.